You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the latest edition of the City of Man podcast. This is Ed Song. I am an associate professor of philosophy at Westmont College in sunny Santa Barbara, California. And I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Coyle Neal, who is an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. How are you doing, Coyle?
I'm doing all right, Ed. It's also sunny here, much to all of the farmers' chagrin, no doubt.
How has your semester wound down?
It's winding. I've got a giant stack of papers that I am avoiding grading by doing a podcast. So thank you for this. I appreciate it.
Coyle, how many years have we been podcasting? Are we entering our third year, I guess?
You know, I have no idea. We're at 50-some episodes.
Yeah, so our two-year anniversary would have been sometime early last month, about a month ago. We kind of missed that, didn't we?
Right.
Sorry, I forgot to get you something.
It's okay. I didn't get you anything either.
What is the second anniversary anyway? Do you know which anniversary that is?
I have no idea. The first five are all kind of ridiculous. They're like paper and wood.
Yeah. Let's just say it's lead, and that will make today's topic appropriate. That takes us to our topic of today, which is guns and the Second Amendment. This is a topic that Coyle and I have probably talked about doing from the beginning. And given all the things that have been happening in the last few years, in terms of the horrific mass shootings, there have been more than a few since our podcast has been running, right? But in any case, it's obviously a topic of great import and discussion. We apologize for not having gotten to it. But now we finally have. And interestingly, Coyle and I haven't talked a ton about this topic. And I think my views are pretty much what you would expect them to be. Your views, I think, are going to be what I expect them to be. But there's obviously a great deal of nuance that can go on in all of this. So with all of that said, as intro, Coyle, do you want to kick us off and try to get us situated here with regard to talking a little bit about the history of guns and the Second Amendment in the United States?
Yeah, so probably useful just to read the Second Amendment and then talk through some of the history of guns.
Great.
So the Second Amendment says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, which is a terrible, terrible sentence. And we should have lots and lots of English professors in the Christian Humanist Network. If one of you guys want to try to diagram that for us, that would be super helpful. Because it's a doozy. So basically, this amendment has two sides. There's the side that deals with militias, and then the side that deals with guns. And the big overarching question is which of those sides is more important? Both of them have a history. They both have unfolded over time in slightly different ways. But let me just pick one and walk through, and Ed, jump in anytime here to comment or whatever.
Yeah, great.
So in terms of militias, these go back to the early colonial era. So local militias were originally tied to local city governments when the original colonization was going on. The British military was, for various reasons of both distance and political events back home, unavailable to protect the colonies. So colonies were responsible for organizing and protecting themselves. And as the individual colonies grew and formed larger colonial governments, the militias were then tied to these larger colonial governments. when our conflict with the mother country, with the national government, started to grow in the 1760s and into the 1770s, the British basically passed laws trying to disarm the colonial militias. So the formal colonial militias were disbanded, and new militias were then formed that were independent of the old militias, but basically the same thing. They would then go on to form the backbone of the Continental Army. The militias during this time and then going into the early republic had sort of three functions. They were the alternative to a standing army. Standing armies are seen as tools of tyrants and dictators sort of at all times. Often they are made up of mercenaries. So, of course, we have all of the propaganda from the American Revolution about the Hessians and the Redcoats and so on. Militias also functioned as the state police. States did not have organized state police forces. That's actually a fairly late development. So I had a student do a presentation today on the Arkansas State Police. They were formed in 1935. So prior to that, any kind of organized law enforcement would have been handled by a militia at the state level, of course. Then there still would have been local stuff. After the 1789 Constitution, and we see this especially in the Anti-Federalist writings, militias were understood to serve as a check on the growth and power and influence of the federal government. The Constitution then gives the federal government sort of emergency control over state militias, but it basically leaves everything to the state to organize and coordinate. So the state is functionally in charge of the militia, though if there's an emergency, as often happens during wartime, the feds can step in and take over. Fast forward then 60 years or so into the Civil War. We could do an entire episode on militias in the Civil War. Basically, the South did as well as it did militarily because their militias had stayed in shape largely to help prevent or resist slave revolts, while the Northern ones had fallen into disuse. So the Civil War, the militias really come into their own, especially in the Southern Army. Ironically, that's sort of what brings militias to an end. Once there is a standing army, both in the North and in the South, and then after the war, of course, just in the North, the militia system falls into disuse, starts to get sort of flabby everywhere. So the federal government steps in and passes the Militia Act of 1903. This creates the militia system that we still have today, and people are often surprised to hear that we do, in fact, still have a militia system today, because we tend to think of our standing army. What this Militia Act does is creates two militias in the United States. The organized militia that eventually becomes the National Guard. This is technically under state control, but is funded by the feds, has to meet federal regulations. And of course, it's the National Guard. We all should be somewhat familiar with that. But there's also the unorganized militia. That's whatever the states want to do on their own. It's everything left over with almost no federal involvement. Most states don't do much with this, although most states also have some variant of all males, you know, ages 18 to 50 or whatever, are officially part of the state militia. That's usually written somewhere in the state constitution. And then if the state has a military academy, that's usually a part of this unorganized militia. Mm-hmm. So the Virginia Military Institute would be the most famous of these. Mm-hmm.
But this is different from National Guards. And it's also different from these civilian militias.
Yes.
Which are basically just dudes with guns.
Right. So those are not militias in any official sense at all, since they're not connected to a government. They're just people living in compounds, usually in Montana or Idaho.
All over. They were all over Charlottesville in force in August. But anyways, okay. Those are dudes with guns.
Yeah. So that is no formal militia of any kind. Really, the only thing that the federal government does with the unorganized militia is there's a program called the Civilian Marksmanship Program, which is exactly what it sounds like. They provide resources if you want to learn how to shoot. There are federal resources for that, for city governments, for state governments, or for, you know, groups of individuals who want to do that sort of thing. So that's sort of the history of militias. I didn't find a whole lot of Supreme Court law on that, other than the laws that are tied to, you know, the draft during the war and those sorts of things.
Sure.
Where the court really gets into it is when we start talking about individual firearm ownership, kind of the other side of the Second Amendment. Anything you wanted to add on militias? I assume we're functionally done with those for a while.
No, that's great.
So individual ownership of guns, prior to the Civil War, laws are defined by these militia requirements. Everybody has to own a gun and know how to use it, or at least all males over the age of 18. You're obligated to show up at the militia training, once or twice a month, or however often your local government does it, with your gun ready to, basically ready to shoot. Post-Civil War laws are often governed by public safety requirements. So in the Old West, sort of the end of the Civil War through 1890 or so, towns required people to check their firearms on entering or leaving the city. So, for example, the first law passed by the newly formed government of Dodge City, Kansas, in 1878 was a prohibition on carrying firearms in town. So you could have your guns on your way into town. You could have your guns on your way out of town. But if you were caught with your guns on while you were doing your business around the town, you were fined and occasionally jailed for doing that. Similar law was on the books in Tombstone, Arizona. At the famous gunfight at the OK Corral, two members of the Clanton gang were unarmed. They ran away from the fight and survived, although they were later killed in out-of-town gunfights. All of these... So these are very harsh laws. These are technically harsher laws, I think, than currently exist anywhere on the books. So the Old West was stricter on guns than anywhere in modern America. But they're sort of paralleled by a very widespread gun literacy. I don't know if that's the right term. If you know about guns, are you literate? I mean, I don't know if that's the right word to use there.
Is that riding with guns?
Yeah. Familiar with guns, I guess. Whatever the term is, everybody knew their way around one, and everyone carried one for safety when they weren't in town, against wild animals, against criminals, against Native Americans, and on and on and on. Likewise, not carrying the gun was not the same thing as not owning one. So storekeepers kept guns close for self-defense or as part of citizens' committees, sort of a group of amateur first responders who could grab their rifle and respond to a bank robbery or so on. And then the other factor, as I was reading up on this, in post-Civil War America, was that the kinds of guns varied pretty widely. So if you watch the Old West movies, it's always the sheriff has a six shooter and the bad guy has a six shooter, and whoever is faster with the gun wins. And that's sort of the good versus evil trope. In reality, if you are in a city, the lawmen are going to carry rifles or shotguns. And those are usually vastly superior to whatever pistols someone is carrying in off the range that they've been using for self-defense. As one article I was reading said, Winchester trumps Colt every time, and in close quarters, the double-barrel shotgun is king. So the kind of gun you're using is also relevant.
Sure. Yeah, you don't really need to aim those double-barrel
shotguns. No, and if you're in a city, you're going to be in close quarters, so they're still going to be... if you're far enough away, a shotgun's not very effective. But if you're in a city, it's you're going to win. You're going to win that fight. Up until the 20th century, the point of all this is that most gun laws were state or local, and they were dealt with in state courts, and state courts almost always upheld them. So the argument that my constitutional rights are being taken away by the city ordinance just was not a winner at all, basically anywhere in the country. On the rare occasions that it did win, it was usually based on some state constitution. And often what would happen is the state would then amend its constitution so that these local communities could keep passing whatever sorts of gun legislation they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
The federal government gets involved with guns in the Prohibition era with the National Firearms Act, which has been amended and updated several times. But this is basically still the federal government's primary point of involvement with guns. This act regulates Tommy guns, which, of course, dealing with the mob and so on. Eventually, this means all fully automatic weapons. So that initial restriction on one kind of automatic weapon is now expanded to include all automatic weapons, which I don't know all of the ins and outs on the law of this, but from what I understand, you can still own a fully automatic weapon, but they are required to be licensed, and they're pretty heavily regulated. A friend of mine was telling me, and I assume he knows what he's talking about, that the way the government handles that is every time you sell an automatic weapon, the federal tax that you pay gets added to the value of the gun. So every time you sell one, it becomes more and more and more expensive. So these things sort of price themselves out of existence, basically. By the time you've sold it multiple times, people can't afford to buy them. But they still exist, that you can still own one legally if you can afford it. But they are heavily regulated by the federal government. Short-barreled rifles and shotguns, also heavily regulated. Silencers and explosive devices. Explosive devices meaning things like grenades, but also things like high-caliber weapons, anti-aircraft devices, those sorts of things. This act initially gets challenged in the courts in the case United States v. Miller. This decision, it was unanimous, but it's also sort of notoriously unclear. The case says that the Federal Firearms Act is not unconstitutional. So the implication is that the Supreme Court says the federal government has some right to regulate firearms because it doesn't prevent an organized militia. So the idea is that the government has this right because in restricting these specific kinds of weapons, they're not stopping citizens from forming militias. But by throwing in that it's not preventing a militia, the implication is that the weapons the government are regulating just aren't military grade enough to be protected by the Second Amendment. So machine guns maybe aren't you can't go out and buy a machine gun, but if you can find something, you know, more military than a machine gun, maybe the federal government shouldn't be stopping you from buying that. At least that's sort of the unclear language of Miller. And then after Miller, it's almost 70 years before the court does another Second Amendment case. The court just does not like getting into gun cases for reasons that I'm not entirely clear on. But the next two cases come in the 21st century, District of Columbia v. Heller in 2008 and McDonald v. City of Chicago in 2010. Both of these cases just say that the government, whether the federal government or the state government, can regulate guns but cannot completely ban them. And that's sort of where we're at now. There was another case recently. I don't know all the details of it, but from what I understand, it didn't change either McDonald or Heller or Miller. So the rule is still basically on the books that, yeah, you can regulate guns, but you can't ban them completely. And that's sort of where the law is at. Ed, any questions, thoughts, comments on any of the
individual stuff? So can we talk a little bit about just on some of those constitutional issues?
Sure.
So, you know, you were talking about how the Second Amendment has these two parts. So again, the Second Amendment reads, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So certainly there are two discrete parts there.
But are they discrete? Maybe. I mean,
So I thought that was the point that you were making. I mean, there's the prologue and then the core part of it. But the point that I'm just getting at is that it seems pretty clear from a naive reading of it anyways, right, that it's tying gun ownership to the creation and maintenance of a militia, no?
Yeah, but a militia then in turn is being tied to the state. And state there, I know that there are some schools of constitutional thought that want to read that as the nation, the United States being a state.
Yeah.
If that is the case, then that is the only place in this entire Constitution where the word state is being used that way. If it is tied to the state, as in the individual 50, you know, for 13 and now 50 states, then yes, it's tied to a militia, but that militia is defined by the state. So the implication that being only states get to have laws regulating guns, the federal government has no ground to do that.
Yeah, I guess the point that I was getting at is that it seems to be describing a right of guns that is tied to public safety and security as opposed to a personal right to bear arms.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. I think that's a fair interpretation. I think there is a deeper personal right to bear arms that's not necessarily restricted to the Second Amendment. And I guess if we want to get into this now, that's fine. It's one of the core aspects of Western liberalism, you know, going sort of all the way back to Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, is the right of self-defense. Mm. Hobbes even says if you are you cannot under any circumstances transfer that right. It's sort of the one untouchable right that the state can never take away from you. Mm-hmm. Even the person sitting on death row who's about to be executed, according to Hobbes, has the right to fight back against the hangman. Mm-hmm. So I could see reading this amendment in a way that it is not solely intended to protect individual, you know, to to account for personal defense. I don't think that means you don't have that right.
Yeah, though having the right to self-defense is one thing. Having the right to a particular weapon in order to defend yourself is something else, right?
Right. So you're okay with someone having the right to something but not the means to exercise it?
Well, look, and there's no doubt that Hobbes thought, if we want to go back to Hobbes, that while people possess that right, the state had the power to do virtually anything else, right? And so just because a person does no wrong in resisting the state, that doesn't mean that the state isn't entitled to place restrictions on gun ownership, for one thing. I mean, the state can do anything.
Well, according to Hobbes.
Yeah, so that's right. So, and then equally, I mean, it can't be the case that the right to self-defense allows a person to do just anything, right? So I couldn't develop sarin gas, you know, in my basement and claim to rightfully own it as a tool of self-defense, or nuclear weapons, or a bazooka, or anything like that, right?
I mean, I think it would be unwise.
Yes, but you see my point, right? Right. And so it's got to be the case that the state can regulate those things. And then it's just a question about what the permissible bounds of that regulation is going to include.
Yeah, and David French had an interesting article on this that I put up on the Facebook page a while back. I think he called it the left will never win the argument on guns or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically making the case that whatever you can reasonably expect to be threatened by, you have the right to the equivalent of that or greater. So his argument was like, you know, I am unlikely to be attacked in my home by sarin gas, but an armed intruder is at least a reasonable possibility. It would be unjust for the government to say, okay, you can have a BB gun to defend yourself against someone coming in with a .357.
Mm-hmm.
Right. In my own home, there is some right to superior firepower. Or at least equivalent firepower of whatever the reasonable expectation is. I don't think anyone's going to be attacking my house with a bazooka, but if there were a rash of, you know, black market bazookas in the area, then that would then mean that I have the right to some kind of appropriate defense.
Uh-huh. Of course, you know, one way around that is to make sure that the intruder who's entering your house also doesn't have a weapon.
Right. So I should just ask politely. Please, no. If you're robbing my house, please leave your gun outside so it's fair.
Well, this will get to things that maybe we can get to at the end. But like other countries have significantly less gun violence than the United States precisely because they've been able to enact regulations on guns, right?
Depending on the country and the stats and so on. Adjusting those sorts of numbers for population does have some effect on that. But yeah, in general, that's somewhat true.
No. So that's right. So gun homicides in the United States are orders of magnitude higher than every other civilized country on the planet, right? And that's adjusting. You should link the French article in our show notes. Equally, I mean, there are lots of websites with data like this, but Vox has a nice kind of summary. It's one of their, you know, where they explain a social issue with data.
Right.
So like Australia, for example, has 1.4 homicides, gun-related homicides per 1 million people. And the United States is at almost 30, right? And so the United States looks like an outlier relative to every other advanced industrial state. Industrial nation on the planet with regard to gun deaths. The next highest nation after the United States, at least on this chart, is Switzerland, which also has a pretty high rate of gun ownership. So it's no surprise that they're in second, just given their historic neutrality and their need to muster a civilian army. But they're at 7.7. So they're the next highest at 7.7. Again, the United States is 29.7 gun deaths per million people. And most other countries are sort of like, you know, around 3, let's say.
Right, which again isn't that difference is important, and I do want to get back to that, but it's not necessarily a difference caused by the number of guns. if that makes sense. So Switzerland's a great example. If I remember correctly, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but Switzerland is one of the countries where there are more guns per person, and yet their homicide rates are lower. So it's not just a question of the availability of guns it's not just a question of how many guns are out there and regulations placed on them and so on. There's something else going on.
Yeah, though I think Switzerland is a little bit of an example of the exception to the rule. Switzerland, and again, it's a unique country insofar as their neutrality has created a culture in which, I mean, I think virtually every civilian owns a weapon.
I believe it's mandatory. I think it's...
Exactly. So everybody has a rifle under their bed in case the French come pouring over the Alps.
Which they haven't done. They've had
not yet. And so it's not a surprise in some ways that Switzerland is next on that list. But again, at 7.7 gun homicides per million, again, versus the United States, 29.7. I would say that Switzerland, again, is a little bit of an outlier just because of those weird historic and social political circumstances. But there's a direct correlation between the number of guns in circulation and homicides. And you can look at a plot of gun ownership over and against homicides, and you get a very clear, direct, linear relationship. Switzerland is an outlier, but every other country lies on this line. And then you can look at it within countries and states. States with higher levels of gun ownership are also subject to higher numbers of shootings. I'm looking at a chart right now on gun ownership versus gun deaths.
Well, you switch terms there, though. I would say that's a higher number of shootings.
Sorry.
Not necessarily higher numbers of homicides.
Sorry, no. Right? I misspoke. Gun deaths. You can look at a plot of gun ownership versus gun deaths, and there is a pretty strong direct linear relationship. Alaska has the highest rate of gun ownership. They have the highest number of gun deaths per 100,000 residents. There are a couple weird outliers in there, but you get a pretty clear linear plot when you look at that. And that plot holds up within the United States, and it holds up outside of the United States. Switzerland has lower gun ownership rates than the United States in any case. It might be at least in terms of the number of guns per, it might be the case that the gun ownership rate is really high.
Right.
But the number of guns per 100 people is significantly lower than the United States.
Right. Everyone has one gun instead of, you know, my cousin with his 40.
Yeah, yeah. And so the crazy thing about gun ownership in the United States is that I think something like around 40% of all U.S. households, so this is talking about households, have at least one gun in it. But then when you look at gun ownership rates, something like 3% of the American population own 50% of all the guns. So 40% of all households have a gun, but like the number of guns, when you look at all the guns in the United States, they tend to be owned by a very small minority. And if you look at that 3%, to be in that 3% means that you have anywhere between 8 and 140 guns, which is a lot of guns.
Right.
But in any case, there is a very direct correlation between the number of guns that are in circulation and levels of gun deaths. Okay, but anyways, what were we talking about before we got?
We just finished talking about the Second Amendment and the Constitution.
Yeah, yeah. So like my strict constructionist interpretation of the Constitution is that like when you look at the actual language, it's not talking about a personal right of ownership. It's talking about the right to own guns is tied to participation in militias. Though if I'm being honest, at this point, when you look at Supreme Court rulings through the 19th and 20th centuries, I mean, it's pretty clear that they've established something like a personal right to own guns.
Yeah, yeah. So especially Heller and McDonald have functionally incorporated the Second Amendment, and I disagree with that use of those decisions. I'm being a strict constructionist. I'm fine with saying if a state wants to ban guns or a local community wants to ban guns, it can ban guns. We can talk about whether that's a good policy or not, but I don't have an objection to that. Now, I don't think the federal government has the right to do that.
Yeah,
I think the federal government does not have that right or that ability. But so states want to strip themselves of militias. That's mm-hmm. their prerogative.
Yeah, you know, I think I disagree with your reading on drawing that distinction between the federal government's ability to do it and the state. Even if, and so that turned on trying to figure out what the referent of that word state is in the language of the Second Amendment, whether that means like the country or individual states.
Yeah, it's not the country.
Well, so that's fine. I mean, I'm actually fine with that, right? But just because it ties militias specifically to states, that doesn't mean that the federal government doesn't have the right to regulate guns within states. It's just saying a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
Right. So I would say that if the federal government is trying to tell a state what it can or cannot do with its militia, it is infringing the right of the people to keep and bear arms.
Yeah. So I would say that right is distinct from anything in there, right? So it's just saying the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed since militias are necessary to the security of a free state. But it doesn't say that states have the right to do whatever the heck they want with militias. But like, that's a little bit of a moot point. I mean, so in some ways, you're a little bit more consistent on Second Amendment issues than a lot of other originalists are in the way that they read the Constitution.
Yeah, I hope so. Or I think so anyway.
So Scalia, I think, is famously supports a pretty broad personal right to own arms, despite his commitment to originalism. You know, but in some ways, this never, I don't think this came out in our discussion of constitutional issues, but there's a funny way in which, so on this issue, I mean, so I'm not originalist, and you know that, and I think that this is a way in which I'm being consistent on my interpretation of it, like, whatever the original text says, the way in which we interpret and apply it is shaped by Supreme Court precedent, right? And then I would say at this point, it's probably clear that personal right to bear arms in the United States is pretty well established.
In at least the broadest possible sense.
Yeah, yeah. Which still leaves it open that the manner in which that gun ownership is exercised can be constrained in various different ways. Right. That also seems to me to be very, very well established. But in any case, on those, you know, constitutional issues, that's a little bit less controversial between you and me than I might have guessed. Though I'm not surprised by what you just said. But anyways.
Yeah, I mean, there is something, and I've seen this this meme going around Facebook. There is something to the argument that the Second Amendment has to mean something practical today. The meme that I've seen is, you know, if we are interpreting the First Amendment to cover things like the internet and cell phones and so on, then the Second Amendment isn't just protecting muskets, right? It has to be something broader than that. And I think there's something to that. I tend to think the way to interpret that is to go through the state militia route rather than through the I as an individual have the right to purchase whatever I want route. I think you're right. It's clearly a collective amendment of some kind, although understanding that states can interpret that how they want.
You want to keep going and talk a little bit about some more recent recent controversies?
I mean, I don't want to talk about mass shootings, but that's what always brings this up,
yeah,
right?
So
there will be some kind of shooting somewhere, and then this conversation will start again, and then people will get irritated because this conversation is starting again. School and mass shootings are rare, but when they happen, they are big news. But even sort of how we talk about this can be a challenge because what counts as a mass shooting? What counts as something mm-hmm. like that? One of the most popular websites, shootingtracker.com, says that any shooting where more than four people, including the shooter, are shot or wounded, counts as a mass shooting. Now, the actual things that they include on the website can be questionable since it's all crowdsourced. So, you know, it's exactly as valuable as information from all over the internet is. But that's not to say it's a bad definition necessarily. The FBI uses the term mass killing as a category, where at least three people are killed. and obviously these terms matter, by that first term, you know, more than four people, including the shooter, there were 355 mass shootings in 2015, but only 67 mass killings, according to the FBI category. Or we might use the Congressional Research Service term of mass public killing, which involves at least four people killed with a firearm in a public place, not related to some other crime. So not someone who's killed in the course of a bank robbery or something like that. By that definition, as of 2015, there had been 116 in the entire 20th century. Those 116 were clustered, not completely closer to the second half of the 20th century, but they sort of nudge that direction towards the 80s and the 90s. So even how we talk about it can be a challenge, right? I mean, what counts as sometimes it's clear, sometimes it's not, is the big point there.
Yeah. Can I ask? So, I mean, the thing that set this all off was Columbine.
Yes.
What year was Columbine?
Was it 98? I was still in high school when it happened, and there was actually so I was the next state over from
it was 99 Coyle. Columbine happened in 99.
Yeah, so there was a shooting at a high school in the next town over from me, like the week after Columbine, and I mean it made local news, but it's the sort of thing that it would have been national news had it happened 2 weeks earlier. It was you know, one person, I think one person was killed, two people were killed, something like that. Like it was a, I don't want to say it was a minor affair because of course two people were killed, but in the wake of Columbine, it felt smaller. And I think that's sort of problematic.
I guess like the question that I'm getting at, and so 12 people were killed at Columbine and 21 people were injured. Was there anything like that in the 20th century before Columbine?
Yes. Yeah. So, 1927 in Bath, Michigan, a failed politician bombed the local school, the claim of this article is that that's the worst school massacre in American history. Worst mass shootings, 1917 in East St. Louis, 1921 in Tulsa, Oklahoma, 1873 in Colfax, Louisiana, 1919 in Arkansas. These are all massacres of African Americans, hundreds of people at a time.
Of African, so it's race-related violence.
Yes, but mass killing.
Yeah.
So the Bath Township school bombing killed 44. Yeah. I would say that's probably the largest school attack. I guess it was a bombing. The point is that it is something that happens, but given our communications and media, we notice it more today.
Yeah, that's certainly the case. And you know, there were these really horrific mass killings. I mean, I think of those definitions that you're trotting out, and they're all subjective in some ways, but
sure.
the last one that you mentioned, Congressional Research Service of mass public killing, seems to me in some ways to be the one that gets at the kind of phenomena that we're talking about, right? So then that definition again was four people killed with a firearm in a public place, not related to some other crime.
Right. Now, I don't know if you would include, you know, racial attacks there or not.
Yeah, I mean that's unique in some ways, but it's not unique in others. I think my tendency would be to count. I mean, it would certainly be. And look, I mean, all murders, all deaths are tragic and horrific in their own way.
Sure.
But there's something sort of uniquely horrific about these. We'll call them mass public killing. And while there are incidents much earlier in the 20th century and even worse incidents, at least by the number, it's certainly the case that since Columbine, that particular kind of a deal has become a kind of a phenomenon that has obviously inspired people.
Right. Although, again, I don't know that it's necessarily more common than it used to be. It is, but it is certainly more noticed.
Yeah, but really, so, you know, so Columbine is 99. You talked about this incident in Bath, Michigan, and in East St. Louis, and something else in 1921. I mean, that's all before, that's all in the 1920s and earlier. I mean, I just don't think that if you go back into, well, in our lifetime, let's say, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, that you find, I mean, part of it is certainly a phenomenon of media, because everybody sees it, everybody knows about it, it's heavily reported, and kind of imprints itself on our public imagination, and so is subject to copycat people who are inspired by the act. But I think it's wrong to say that it's been happening at the same level of frequency, but we just haven't noticed it as much. Maybe that's true, but I would really want to see. Maybe I just need to go back and look at one of these articles.
And I'll link these in the show notes. With that said, it does happen, right? Whatever the frequency over time. And I think there are still some common factors that kind of stretch across all of these events. Anything else you want to say about kind of the definitions of them?
No, go on.
Yeah. So the criteria that are functionally universal amongst all non-religious mass shootings, whether in a school or not, mass public killing, I guess, to use the Congressional Research Service term. Non-religious mass public killings, so not counting, you know, the Fort Hood shooting or the San Bernardino Mall shooting. They're done by white males with guns who are either on or have just gone off of some kind of psychiatric medication.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the criteria, and of those factors, it makes sense that we're going to focus in on the guns, because that's the one thing that it is easy to politically regulate.
Yeah, but I mean, it's obviously the case that, I mean, it's not just that it's easy to regulate that. It's that if they didn't have access to guns, or those kinds of guns, or those kinds of bullets, or those kinds of magazines, they certainly wouldn't have been able to create that scale and level of devastation.
Well, you could make the same argument about the psychiatric medication, right? If they didn't have access to that, maybe they wouldn't have done it at all. But we don't want to outlaw or, you know, seriously restrict that. Obviously, there are people who need it, and there are people who genuinely need it.
Well, look, it's obviously not a question of restricting psychiatric medication. It's a question of like making sure that everybody who has severe psychiatric needs receives the treatment that they get. But my point is that you don't get these mass shootings in countries that have restricted access to guns, or they're not as widespread, or they're not as frequent, or they're not as devastating. Like, there are mass killings in other countries. There was a knife attack in China not long ago, and that person did a lot of damage. But it's obviously a lot harder to achieve those scales of devastation with a knife than it is with a gun. The point that I'm getting at is that like guns are uniquely lethal. You know, even like the vast majority of all gun deaths in the United States. So there were about 39,000, a little less than 39,000 gun deaths in 2017, and the majority of those are suicides. And so, in some ways, people sort of you might want to set those numbers aside as not counting because they're self-inflicted. But like even those deaths count, if only because the suicide rate in other countries, again with restricted gun access, is lower. And you're far more likely both to try to kill yourself and to succeed in killing yourself if you have a gun at your disposal. I think the suicide, the death rate for attempted suicide for other methods is low. Like, it's comparatively harder to kill yourself with sleeping pills or drugs, but the success rate for firearm suicides is like almost 100%. Obviously. You know, so it's not like the tool that's used is immaterial.
Right. And again, it can be hard to know how to factor those. You know, do you factor out suicides? Do you factor out accidents, right? Hunting accidents and so on. Do you factor out things that happen in the process of committing a crime, where it's sort of accidental, but you know, you're committing a crime along the way. I mean, again, there's part of the argument is how do we figure all of that, and what are the numbers when we're done, and so on. One other factor, at least in terms of mass public shootings, is firearms training. I don't know exactly how to fit these two stats together, but at least in the state of Texas, which is the only state I've seen stats for, concealed carry permit holders have a lower crime rate than police officers. But of the mass shooters that sort of everyone agrees are mass shooters, about a third of them have a military background, and they tend to be much more deadly as a result. So, does some kind of firearms training make it less likely that you're going to use a weapon in the commission of a crime? Well, maybe. Mostly yes, I think. Yes, no. Mostly yes. Because, again, there are very, very, very small numbers of people who engage in mass shootings. There are a lot of concealed carry permit holders. So I think the answer is mostly yes, but you can't just ignore the firearms training factor or, you know, military background in the mass shooters.
You know, part of it is, I wonder how much of that is, there's a correlation causation question. How much of that is that the training is really, really good? And how much of that is that if you're the kind of person who's going to go out of their way to get a conceal carry permit and go through the training, then you're just happen to be the kind of person who's less likely to commit to unjustifiably kill a person with a weapon.
Right. You're sort of de facto a good citizen, right? If you're getting a permit to do something that no one will know you're doing anyway. Which I guess we didn't talk about that. Should we mention the different kinds of sort of carry?
Yeah. So that, you know, there's the ankle holster, there's the hip holster, obviously.
Right. Right. I'm preferable to the shoulder holster myself, but
I prefer to keep my weapon just strapped to my back, kind of Terminator style, so I can just reach up with both hands and grab a weapon.
Right.
My sawed-off shotgun's one in each hand. Yeah, but that's my go-to.
Never down the front of the pants, though.
Oh, come on! Yeah, that's a rookie move. Everybody knows not to do that.
Basically, the options that different states have come up with. I don't have a name for the first one. Maybe there's something official. I just don't know it. But I guess call it regulated, where the idea is you can own a weapon, you can keep it in your house, in your vehicle, or while you're out hunting. But otherwise, it stays away somewhere. Concealed carry, or when you can carry the weapon around with you, you know, under your jacket. It doesn't have to be out in the open. Open carry is when you are carrying a weapon around with you, but it's, you know, on your hip in a holster, or on your back if you're carrying a legal shotgun, or whatever. And then most recently, we've seen pop up this thing called constitutional carry, which I have some very, very mixed thoughts about. It basically says that you can carry a weapon without a permit, even concealed, anywhere where the governing authority hasn't said that you can't. Mm-hmm. So Missouri is now a constitutional carry state. If I wanted to, I could, you know, put a gun under my jacket and carry it all over the place, although not on campus here at Southwest Baptist University because firearms are not allowed. But anywhere else in town, government buildings, those sorts of places, I could.
Yeah, so just a free-for-all, basically.
Pretty much, yeah. Like I said, I have very mixed thoughts on that.
I would say, yeah, my thoughts on that aren't mixed, but anyways. You know, we were talking about the mass shootings front and there are these questions of definitions and what should count and what shouldn't count. To me, mass shootings are both not unusually significant and important and extremely unusual and significant and important. So, I mean, even right. If you go with the, you know, the broadest, most capacious definition of whatever we're talking about, I mean, all of those deaths are still going to be a rounding error in the total number of gun deaths in a given year. And again, so it was almost 39,000 in this past 2017 year. Whether there were 355 mass shootings or 67 mass killings, even if you go with the most capacious number, that's not, you know, barely going to be a rounding error in, you know, in the total number of gun deaths in a country. And a gun death, is a gun death, right? That's the way in which I think those kinds of things are not particularly important, you know, but they are particularly important in, and even if their incidence has increased, I mean, the odds of actually being a victim to a mass shooting or mass violence like that is like extremely low, right?
The odds of being a victim to any kind of shooting are extremely low unless you're in one of the few places where the odds are high.
Yeah, sure.
Right. So if where I live in Bolivar, Missouri, the odds that I will be shot are functionally zero.
Yeah.
If I drive up and cross the river to East St. Louis, I think it's like 1 in 25. I mean, the number skyrockets exponentially. So it does depend on where you are.
Sure. But for the vast majority of people in the country, you're far more likely to die taking a bath, right, than you are from any
kind of driving a car.
Driving a car, it's infinitely higher. But
eating that extra, double cheeseburger from McDonald's, yeah.
That's why I always stop with one, because I don't want to double my risk. but yeah. Obviously, they're very, very significant in some ways. In part, just again, like what you were saying about children in schools. There's also a great danger when you're talking about 39,000 gun deaths to sort of allow that number just to become a kind of a statistic that it's easy to be cold about, right? But that's 39,000 people who are dead, 39,000 husbands and wives and daughters and sons and all of that, people who are no longer going to be around, whose lives are, whose deaths are crippling tragedies for the people who knew them. And also because I think those mass killings are symbolic reminders of just the fact that even though it's a rounding error on the 39,000, they are particularly grotesque symbolic reminders of just how much gun violence there is in the United States, which again is orders of magnitude higher than every other advanced industrialized country in the world, and puts us, it's the same level of gun violence as like places like Afghanistan. And that's an exaggeration, but when you look at comparing us to other countries, are the other countries who are in our company or not is a motley list of nasty places to be. And so there are almost 40,000 gun deaths, every year that do not happen in other parts of the world. And it's not like even our, the rates of violent and even nonviolent crime in the United States are very comparable to other countries. Like there are countries that are a little bit safer and there are countries that are a little bit more dangerous. But the United States in terms of the total levels of violent and nonviolent crime is basically comparable to other like Western European advanced industrialized nations. Like we're all about the same level of violent and nonviolent crime, but it's like that gun death rate. It's the actual rate of homicide in the United States is starkly higher just because we're way into guns and there are so many guns in our country. And so to me, like the significance of these mass shootings are just that they're kind of a symbolic reminder of all of those gun deaths that happen in the United States that just don't happen anywhere else.
Right. And I would certainly agree with you about not letting the statistic dehumanize the people who have died. I would also say we shouldn't let the statistic dominate the conversation, because as you pointed out, it is a fairly small number of deaths overall relative to the other sorts of deaths, and when you factor out suicides, the number of murders per year using guns is declining, which is a positive trend. Now, the overall number is going up because suicides are increasing. And again, I think that gets at the underlying problem that really needs to be addressed rather than the sort of surface issue of guns. In either case. Yes, sir, go ahead.
I was just going to say, do you want to jump to what you take the underlying issue to be?
I guess just to, before we jump to that, to round out the mass shooting stuff. You wanted to talk policy a little bit.
Well, I don't have super worked out ideas in my head. I mean, the thing that would really help is if we adopted the gun policies of every other advanced industrialized country on the planet and basically made it really, really hard to have access to guns. I mean, that kind of solves the issue that you were talking about earlier from the French article about how people should have the right to defend themselves with, you know, adequate means with regard to the threats that they may face. And that isn't an unreasonable argument. But in some ways, you can look at that at two ways. If everybody have access to guns, then everybody needs to have access to guns. But the other way to look at that is that if you could get guns out of everybody's hands, then you could still honor that general moral principle by just restricting access to gun and making it hard for everybody to get them. That's what I think we should do, and just get rid of guns in the country, or greatly restrict access to them.
So you're functionally saying we need to amend the Constitution.
Well, so and then I was just going to say, given the Constitution, and a little bit more importantly, given the kind of culture, the gun culture that we have in the United States, I think that option is functionally impossible. You know, certainly in our lifetime, and striving towards a society in which guns are less of a part of our identity is something that I think all people, all Christians, all people should strive for. But that is a multi-generational cultural shift to strive for, not anything right. that we're going to accomplish in our lifetime. Though, you know, gun ownership rates are dropping, and but anyways. Right. So
although we should probably note that the gun culture is largely not responsible for the murders and mass shootings. Right, it's not the local NRA members who are going out and doing this stuff. I think there is a good argument that the gun culture is related to it, but it is by and large not the people who love hunting and love, you know, target shooting and love, you know, collecting weapons or whatever, who are engaging in either mass shootings or individual murders.
I guess I'll just say this. I wouldn't just throw suicides out. I mean, suicides are different than mass shootings or other kinds of violent gun acts. But they're not insofar as they are preventable gun deaths. And the fact of the matter is, if you are suicidal and you have access to a gun, you're going to kill yourself. If you are suicidal and you don't have access to a gun, you are much less likely to kill yourself.
Right. And I wouldn't throw them out. I lack the knowledge about the numbers of suicides to know, you know, how many of them are deeply entrenched in the gun culture versus how many of them are just people who decide they want to commit suicide and have access to a gun. Like there is a difference there.
Yeah. There are people who want to commit suicide who have access to guns. Like the suicide rate for people who try to kill themselves by cutting is extremely low. Like it's really hard to kill yourself with a knife. Sorry, I was just looking at something about that, and now I don't know what I did with it. But it's something like 5%. Similarly, by using drugs or poison, the success rate or the failure rate, depending on how you want to think about it, is 5%, right? There's a 5% chance that you'll kill yourself, that you'll succeed in killing yourself with a knife or with poison. Obviously, with a gun, it's almost 100%, right? And so it's an access issue, which I tie to like the gun culture issue. It's like the fascination with guns that causes lots of people to own guns. And if you have access to a gun, then you're just a lot more likely to harm yourself or to harm someone who you love than if you don't have access to a gun.
Well, and again, we may be using gun culture in two different ways here, right? So when I think gun culture, I really do think the people who incorporate guns into their lifestyle sort of intentionally. So not necessarily like where I grew up on a ranch, like my bedroom had our gun cabinet in it. Like I wouldn't say that means that I am part of the gun culture, just because they were tools, right? They were sort of both family heirlooms, things that, you know, my great-grandfather had passed down and great-grandfather passed down and so on. And they were tools that we used around the ranch. But there wasn't really a celebration of them. Like it wasn't, you know, that we would, you know, intentionally go out shooting and love it and so on. But there are people who sort of embrace that, who bring it into their lifestyle. So when you say gun culture, that's sort of what I hear. And I'm not sure that's what you mean. I think you might just mean the fact that there are guns in our society.
I guess I'm using it in a more capacious way. And so when I talk about gun culture, I would include your kind of gun ownership in that. But maybe in some ways, I also particularly mean something beyond that, which is just like the American, what I would say is a perverse kind of fascination and glorification with guns. But in some ways, but the thing that really matters is it's all about gun access. You were resisting the significance of gun access at least a little bit early on, and I don't know how much you want to push back on that. But I mean, so, to me, like the culture, whether it is the more low grade kind of a gun culture that you were talking about in your own childhood, or the more kind of robust gods and gun bumper sticker on your car, that kind of perverse triumphalism about guns that you see in other parts of the culture. That all leads to ownership and access. And the fact of the matter is that like access and ownership is directly tied to death, whether you're killing someone else or you're killing yourself.
Right. Again, though, I would hesitate to attribute. So of those, 39,000, I don't know the suicide numbers, right? But of the mass killing numbers and the murder numbers, I don't know that either of those cultures that I described are responsible. Right? I don't know that it is members of those cultures who are going out and shooting people. I suspect that there is a different part of American culture, sort of widely understood, that's at least in part responsible. It's not the people who collect guns, not the people who use guns as tools. It's another part.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about that, Coyle. I mean, if you look at both the Sandy Hook and the Parkland cases, I mean, those kids grew up in gun houses.
Right.
And shooting was a big part of their lives. I think the same is true of the South Carolina church shooting. Those kids grew up in gun cultures.
Yeah.
The Las Vegas shooting case, I'm assuming, is the same, actually. Though that's a little bit harder for me. But I'm assuming that dude, like, he went out and started stockpiling guns in the months leading up to the Las Vegas shooting. But I'm assuming that first gun that he bought amongst all the hundreds of guns that he was stockpiling wasn't the first gun that dude ever owned.
Well, and I think I'm stealing this from a friend of mine who wrote an article that, again, we'll throw up in the show notes. Thinking about these different cultures in the United States, he sort of asks the question, where would you feel safer walking down the street? In Helena, Montana, which is, sort of the heart of gun culture America, or in downtown Chicago, where guns are functionally forbidden? And I mean, I think the answer is pretty clear, right? I would walk down the street in Helena, Montana without a second thought. Walking down the street in downtown Chicago, I would do it, but it would be with an expectation of, look, there's a good chance something bad is going to go down. I know what the crime rate is here. I know what the odds are. My wallet is going to be taken from me by force or otherwise. So again, I'm not entirely sure that there's a gun culture underlying these shootings. I think there is a cultural cause. I'm not sure it's that one.
So look, I mean, that's in a certain kind of way, that's obviously the case. When I was in college in New Haven, Connecticut, there were certain neighborhoods that you could be sure if you walked through them at night, you would be mugged. Though actually, the muggers were kind of polite about it, and they would almost never hurt you. But I think there's a way in which you're drawing a line around a certain kind of gun death and not other kinds of gun deaths. So I understand that there's a difference between being shot out on a street in a drive-by gang shooting and a gun-related suicide. But again, like, those are both gun-related deaths that are directly tied to issues of accessibility. In a certain kind of a way, they're different. But in the most kind of a way, I think they're not different at all. They both have the same kind of normative significance. And then I can tell you that the gun ownership rate in Montana is over 50%, and that there are something like 16 or 17 gun deaths per 100,000 residents. And then I can tell you that the gun ownership rate in Illinois is under 30%, call it 27%, and there are 7 gun deaths per 100,000 residents.
Depending on which part of Illinois you're talking about.
Well, that's right. So I'm just looking at the state. But the point that, again, that I'm getting at is that there is a direct linear correlation between rates of gun ownership and rates of gun deaths, right? Which, again, isn't in a surprise. That case,
right. So I'm factoring out suicides there. Those 16, 17 gun deaths in Montana are largely suicides and occasionally hunting accidents. They are mostly not violent crime.
Well, okay, well, so how many people died of violent crime in Illinois, throwing out the same kind of number? I don't know that it's higher. Why
I
think that
would
it's higher?
Imagine it's higher.
I do not know about that.
Yeah, and I don't have those stats in front of me.
So, you know, a boyfriend and girlfriend are drunk and having a fight. You know, if somebody has a gun, the odds of, I mean, if there isn't a gun in the house, nobody's going to die of a gun death. If there is a gun in the house, then the odds of that gun being used are like, right? That's my point. That happens in Montana.
It does. It is not common.
You know, there aren't many gang related shootings probably in Montana, but I don't know that gang related shootings constitute any kind of majority of the kinds of killings. And there's just a way in which I think psychologically we respond in a certain kind of a way to certain kind of threats and overestimate how frequently they occur. I'm sure the vast majority of gun deaths that aren't suicide related, I'll bet you anything they're domestic violence related. They're definitely not gang related. I mean, that's kind of the thing. It's like fights happen at bars or between boyfriend and girlfriend or between spouses in a house. If there's a gun there, then it's very easy for that fight to escalate into something lethal. But if there is no gun there, the odds of something lethal happening are just extremely low. It all comes down to access. If there were, like, that is the indisputable iron law. Gun ownership is tied to gun death. It's true in the United States. It's true in every state. It's true globally. If there aren't guns around in a place, there are fewer people who would be killed. And so to get back to that earlier point that I was making, like, the obvious solution to me is to get rid of all the guns. That's unlikely to happen in the United States in our lifetimes for sure. And I think even in the medium and long run, just because there is this unique fascination with guns that happens in the United States because of our history. And so, I think the thing to do is to very slowly work to overcoming that kind of fascination with guns. And in the meantime, to try to institute some pretty common sense things to restrict gun ownership. Because again, we know there's a direct correlation to ownership and gun death. And so if you can restrict ownership, then by that very fact, you're gonna reduce the number of gun deaths. I mean, gun deaths go down in states that institute more restrictive gun laws. I mean, you can see that. That happens in California, which still has relatively high rates of gun deaths just because it's such a large state. But it's declined since they've instituted certain kinds of measures. So, like, that's just you can see it directly. And then chief I have in mind would be things like, I mean, so assault weapons ban for one thing. The AR-15 is a weapon, it's a military weapon that is designed to kill people. The way it shoots a bullet and the velocity and spin of the bullet is like designed to harm people. It's not a particularly accurate weapon. People just own it because it's cool. But like that's not a very good reason. And so assault weapons ban. I'm happy with the idea of owning handguns for personal safety or rifles for hunting, but nobody needs to own an assault rifle. That's a relatively commonsensical restriction that I think doesn't overly impinge upon people's constitutional right to bear a weapon, to bear arms.
And what is an assault rifle?
Yeah, and so there are issues of definition. I mean, in some ways, the best definition is going to be functional, and you just look at the functional capacities of a weapon. That's relatively easy. And the velocity and, you know, the velocity and spin of a bullet, you can just quantify that. That's easy.
I actually have the numbers here from Wikipedia. So the uh, sorry, to go back to your murder, violent assault rate, murder and non-negligent manslaughter. We don't want that. We want gun murder rate. So the gun murder rate in various states, the lowest ranking, Florida, apparently they don't have numbers for. So it's sort of factored out. The state with the lowest gun murder per 100,000 in 2015 is Alabama, coming in at 0.1 gun murder per 100,000 people, followed by Hawaii, New Hampshire, Oregon, Rhode Island, Utah, North Dakota, Maine, Massachusetts. The highest states with the highest gun murders per 100,000, District of Columbia, which I will point out is not a state, Louisiana, Missouri, South Carolina, Delaware, Alaska, Maryland, Georgia, Tennessee. And in terms of Montana versus Illinois, Illinois is 3.4 murders per 100,000 and Montana is 1.7.
And where is Montana in the total list?
It's in the second quartile, but the difference between it and the top state is 1.4 murders per 100,000, whereas the difference between it and Illinois is 2 murders per 100,000.
Yeah. So, I mean...
The difference between the top state and Illinois is 3.3 murders per 200,000, or per 100,000.
We'll have to put that up. None of that surprises me. But again, like, I don't know why we're clipping aside suicides out of that.
Because there is a different state interest there, right? So the state has an interest in doing things that go out of its way to prevent violent crime. I think the state has an interest in preventing suicides, but it's not the same level of interest.
Right? Yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, there's a way in which violent crime against another person is worse than violent crime against oneself. I'm not saying that that's not the case. But I am saying that any kind of inflicted harm, whether that is on other people or on oneself, is significant. The state has an interest in protecting people who want to kill themselves. Like, suicide is a tragedy. That's significant. Okay? Like, if you want to say that there's a difference, I'm perfectly happy to say that there's a difference. But I still think it's really important that suicide is normatively significant, that we shouldn't be clipping it. And the fact
I'm not saying it's not significant. I'm saying there's a different level of public policy interest in terms of prevention.
Sure, that's fine with me. But again, in just sort of thinking about the tragedy of gun death, Montana has rates of gun death that are over twice that, well over twice that of Illinois, because there are more guns. Because again, like, I'm just looking at this chart, there's just a direct correlation between gun ownership and gun death.
Right. If you don't factor out suicides.
Yes. Which I'm happy to concede are different than homicides, but not so different that they don't matter.
Right. So in terms of your sort of public policy, you know, restricting assault weapons and so on, I think whenever we're considering something like that, kind of the three questions that I want to consider are, first is whatever law is being proposed actually going to be something different, right? So if that law is already on the books, then if the law is already on the books, it's already on the books. We don't need another gun law. So if assault weapons are already against the law, then I am opposed to adding another law saying no. Now
they're not against the law, right?
Well, again, depending on what kind of definition we're going to use.
They used to be against the law, but then the assault weapons ban expired, so they're not against the law. Obviously, because people go out and buy them all the time and kill people.
The second question is: would whatever law is being proposed, if it had been on the books, you know, in the wake of a shooting, which is always when we're talking about this, right? It's always right after a shooting. If that law had been on the books and it had been enforced, would the shooting have been prevented? And if the answer is no, again, why would we support this law? If the person who committed the shooting did not have access to a gun, would they still have attempted some kind of mass murder? So I think the South Carolina church shooter, I think, certainly would have, right? Again, I don't think that last one is determinative, but I think it is a factor, and you know, it is something to think about. And again, these are all sort of surface level policy things. When we're thinking about a new gun law, is it doing something new? Would it actually have stopped anything? Would it have stopped this specific thing? Are all hopefully worthy of consideration. The answer to these are usually no, right? When you're listening to whatever regulations people are proposing, it's usually just a variation of something that's already been restricted. It's usually a variation of something that's already on the books.
Mm-hmm. So I guess I'll just say this. I mean, some of the ways in which you drew those restrictions seemed overly narrow. So, you know, the South Carolina murder, I'll agree with you, almost certainly would have happened with a gun or with a knife. Though, in fact, actually, maybe I'd be a little bit less quick to jump to that conclusion than you are, if only because it takes a lot more courage and a lot more work to try to kill someone with a knife than with a gun. I mean, it's relatively easy if you have access to a gun to sort of decide to do that. It's just much harder to do that with a knife. But in any case, it's almost certainly true, right, that fewer people would have died with a knife than with a gun.
Well, with a knife than with a gun. Maybe not if he'd, you know, blocked the doors and lit the building on fire. I mean, there are lots of ways to kill lots of people. And if you set your mind to do it.
Yeah, cool. Would you rather face an arsonist, a knife-wielding attacker, or a gun-wielding attacker?
Oh, but again, Ed, the question here is, would it have stopped the individual, or would the individual have attempted something?
I know, but Coyle, my point is that question is overly narrow. The question is, would he have been as successful? We're talking about trying to save lives.
It's true.
Not just preventing incidents, right? And then obviously, why draw that question so narrowly? What matters is saving lives. It's almost certainly the case that if he didn't have access to the gun, fewer people would have died. I mean, you don't deny that, do you?
I think that, that third question is the least important of them.
That's crazy. It's the most important of them. We're talking about death.
The question was if the person who had done it would still have attempted some kind of mass shooting. So I'm saying that sort of individual application, that's less important than the other two questions from a public policy perspective. Right. If the answer is this event could not have been stopped under any circumstances because this individual was going to do something, right? That again, it shouldn't define the conversation, but it should at least be some kind of consideration. Which is where those first two questions come in, and that's when we can get into, okay, would restricted access to this specific kind of firearm or firearms in general, would that have had an effect? And if the answer is yes, then yeah, we should go on and consider that.
Well, so yeah, but again, like the way that you're drawing those questions is overly narrow. I mean, is it more likely that the attack would have been less lethal? That's the question to ask, right? Not whether he would have done it or not done it, but like what ultimately matters is the number of people who would have been killed,
right?
That's the normative question. And really, I mean, you can look at a specific case, and it might have been the case that person was hellbound to do something. But again, better with a knife than with a weapon. But a little bit more generally, what matters is like, here's the question. Is it going to be the case that the law is going to reduce the number of gun deaths, of gun-related deaths? And then I think it's the case that with the familiar kinds of gun regulations that various different states impose, it's just the fact that states with tighter gun control laws have fewer gun-related deaths. Like, you are less likely to die in California than you are in Montana from a gun-related death. I'm looking at a chart right now. And so the fact of the matter is, gun regulations work. In states with tighter gun regulations, fewer people die of gun-related deaths.
Right, so including suicides.
Including suicides. And, you know, even going to your list, we could sort of walk through those states, but it wasn't this neat dividing line. Like, it wasn't this neat dividing line in which, like, gun states had fewer homicides.
No, it really wasn't.
It was all over the place.
Yep.
Right.
And again, that's why I maintain the problem is not so much about the tool. There's an underlying cultural problem that's much more serious and much more significant.
Well, yeah, I guess. But I mean, think about, like, what's the difference between Louisiana, which had a lot of gun-related homicides, and Alabama, which had few. Sorry, and those numbers were per 100,000, is that right?
So Louisiana had 8, second only to the District of Columbia, and Alabama had 0.1.
And, you know, we could talk about that, but it's not as if there's this neat dividing line between gun culture states have lower and others don't. What would be interesting would be looking at that vis-a-vis the kinds of gun regulations that are in place. I don't know what the gun regulations in Alabama are like, but there might be certain kinds of things that restrict gun access or restrict the kinds of guns that you can own. But I can also tell you, again, that when you include suicides, which, again, I think are normatively relevant because a gun is killing a person, Alabama, Mississippi, particularly Louisiana, Arkansas, those are really bad states. And the good states are states that have tighter gun control laws. Because again, it's just an access issue. There's no way around that. Any other thing affecting gun deaths is nibbling at the margins. It's all about access. If you have access, it's much more likely that a gun is going to be exercised to kill somebody. Is going to be used to kill.
Well, and again that. As you said, between the top state on the list and the bottom state on the list, they both have some kind of gun culture, right? So I would argue that is not that's not the cause. It's another underlying cultural concern. Now, what that is, like what that underlying cultural concern, from what I understand, there's a lot of discussion over that. So increasing isolation, right? The separation of people from communities and traditional associations, right? The collapse of the American family, the collapse of things like self-restraint and self-discipline. We could go through an entire list of other potential causes. I think sort of what it comes down to is a culture that both glorifies the individual, does not encourage us to exercise restraint over our baser passions, and then, as you said, includes access, more or less limited access to firearms. And I think those first two are just as important as the third one, and in some ways, they're more important because they're what's driving the problem.
I'm not saying that what you just said isn't true, but a couple things. Like, is California a more individualistic state, a state that encourages indulgence and lack of self-defense? Is it more like that than Alabama, or is it less like that?
I would say that there are fewer cultural restraints on individual behavior in California, unless you are, you know, an evangelical Christian running a pregnancy center. With that exception, there are fewer individual restraints built into the culture in California than there are in Alabama. Alabama is still very obviously dominated by a traditional culture, right? The idea of there are certain ways you behave and certain ways you don't.
Yeah. Why are there so much more gun-related deaths in Alabama than in California, then?
Oh, but remember, again, you're still wanting to count suicide, and I'm still denying that.
Yeah,
Alabama is top on the list of fewest murders. I'm not saying it doesn't matter. Yeah, again, I'm not saying it doesn't matter. I'm saying it's less important for public policy.
That's fine. That's fine. I don't disagree with that.
I'm a politician.
Just because something is less important doesn't mean that it's not important. Is it important or is it not important?
It is important. But politically, it is less important.
That's fine. No. The comparative thing, I don't even disagree with. That's fine. I totally agree with you. But less important doesn't mean not important. If it's important, then it's important. If it's not important, then it's not important. You just said it's important. So it's important.
Yeah, that's that sort of black and white thing that I'm not going to agree with that. I think it's okay to have a nuanced view of the world, Ed.
No. Look, that's waving around nuance in this artificial way. The question is, is it the kind of thing that we should be concerned about from a public policy perspective? There are other things that we might be more concerned about. That's fine. That's nuance. But is it the kind of thing that we should be concerned about? And if the answer to that question is yes,
I mean, concerned,
then,
sure.
Yeah, okay, so then by definition, we should be trying to do something about it.
Is it the sort of thing that we should be as concerned about as we're concerned about, say, murder? No, I don't think so.
That's fine. I don't disagree with that. You and I totally agree about that. You and I actually totally agree about everything. And then my point is, if you think it's important, maybe less important than other kinds of considerations, but you think it's important, then we should do something about it. And then I'm just saying that there is this ineliminable iron law direct correlation between access and death. And like everything else that you're talking about cultural considerations, that's fine. But that is on the margins, because you can look at the chart and you just see a direct correlation. You know, the kind of variation that you were talking about explains why some states with equivalent levels of gun ownership have higher or lower levels of gun deaths. But you can look at the chart, which we'll put in the show notes, and you'll just see that there is an iron level correlation. And so if you think that it's important, then you should do things to try to limit gun ownership issues.
Yeah, and I'm willing to say there are things that are important that the government ought not be doing, even though they are important. Regulating suicide is one of them.
Okay.
So again, it's not to say there is no public concern, but it is. I don't know that I want to live under a government that has decided it is going to try to. Oh well, that's not a great way to phrase it, is it?
To make it harder to kill yourself.
Yeah. I mean, what kind of totalitarian nanny state would you have to live in that's actually trying to stop all suicides? I mean, my gosh.
It's one that tries to discourage gun ownership. It's Sweden. It's Germany. It's the UK.
It's
France. It's that horrible country, England, that horrible totalitarian country that we should be trying to liberate because it's so awful. It's every other state on the planet Earth, Coyle.
Yeah,
every single one.
So I'm willing to look at other countries and sort of copy them. I'm more willing to look at Switzerland and copy their social and gun programs than I am all of those other, maybe not quite totalitarian, but certainly nanny states that you just listed. So I guess if we're jumping into the end, what should we do? Sort of my proposal is we need to go back to the older American model or the contemporary Swiss model. Either of those I would be perfectly fine with and move back in that direction. So training and gun literacy, I think, are important things as long as we're going to have a Second Amendment. I mean, it's also true that the American people get sort of dumber and less responsible every year. So I am more and more sympathetic to repeal of the Second Amendment argument, but as long as it's there and as long as there is some kind of good that comes from having an armed population, which we didn't get to that at all, the sort of public good that comes from having people who have guns and know how to use them amongst the citizen body. As long as all of that is there, I'm more on the look. Let's just move back towards the older militia model and have, you know, local communities that run their own militias and train and teach people how to use firearms and become literate with them. And then if you want to, as sort of a concession, bring along with that the old check your guns when you come into town model, I'm fine with that too. I'm okay with both of those things. I think they have the benefit of being constitutional. They have the benefit of having a public policy good attached to them. And they would have the benefit of reducing our gun violence rates to, Lord willing, at least Swiss levels, if not even lower.
So it's weird to me, like you in some ways are defending a far more restrictive regime of gun ownership law than I am. Like you're just fine to like outright ban them in certain kinds of locales. All I'm talking about is assault weapons ban, number one. The gun show loopholes are kind of crazy to me. I mean, just like...
Yeah, there's no such thing as a gun show loophole. That's one of those rumors that goes around. You have to do a background check even at gun shows.
So background check and licensing.
Both apply. If there are state laws about those at all, always apply to gun shows.
So I think that there should be federal laws on background checks and licensing and then raising the minimum age of gun ownership of ownership to 21 from 18, right?
And that's where you're more restrictive than I am. I would say that decision needs to be local or state. And again, my view would empower the citizen body rather than empowering the federal government.
This gets back to one of those many themes that we've talked about. But those are three or four gun regulations that do not exist, that do not federally exist. So there's no question of like just making a law for the sake of making a law or making a law that repeats laws in other places. But the fact of the matter is like we just know that like you can own guns in the state of California. There are a few gun deaths per 1,000, per 100,000 in the state of California than there are in other places. Like my ideal solution is something that is impossible in the short run. And so I recognize that. That's fine.
Well, that's true for both of us.
In the meantime, it makes sense to put in place familiar, relatively unrestrictive gun regulations that make it a little bit harder for people to own guns. And as that reduces the total number of guns that are owned in the United States, then there will be a corresponding reduction in the total number of gun deaths. Obviously, there also need to be certain kinds of regulations with regard to mentally unstable persons owning guns. I don't know what you think about that. But
I mean, those laws are largely on the books already. The issue is if someone has not yet been diagnosed as mentally unstable, how on earth do you, what do you do with that?
Yeah. You know, that's true. That's true.
I mean, it's sort of like we don't want felons to own firearms either. But, I mean, if someone has not yet committed a felony, how do you restrict that?
Yeah, no, that's true. That's a little bit of a tricky thing. But insofar as somebody has been diagnosed with a mental disorder, that person shouldn't be able to own a gun.
Well, everyone agrees on that. The problem there is enforcement, right? I mean, how do you know if someone has been diagnosed? There are things like patient confidentiality, and a lot of the reporting is voluntary, and it's not like gun sellers have access to psychiatrist files, nor should they. I mean, yeah, that's I don't know what the answer to that one is, but
yeah,
nobody knows what the answer to that one is.
But the other things, I think we do know what the answers are. They're familiar kinds of gun regulations. I would say that they're not overly onerous in restricting people's access to weapons. And states that have them have fewer gun deaths. So what's wrong with that? Like, we don't need to retreat to your more radical picture of like the good old days.
Or at least the more responsible days, the more unified community days. I don't know that I would say they're the good old days, but they're days when people were more involved in their own individual and communal protection and responsibility.
I sometimes wonder the extent to which talk of those days isn't a nostalgic description of something that didn't exist or whatever. But
well, okay, let's call it the current Swiss model then. I'm fine with that.
Again, Switzerland is a country that isn't anything like the United States.
Well, strong history of federalism, strong combination of sort of a communal identity
and
individualism.
And again, it's not like they're number two on the list of gun deaths amongst.
That's true.
So again, like this ironclad relationship between ownership and death is unavoidable. Okay, well, we've gone round and round on this. We should probably wrap things up.
So the only thing that I had on the outline that I would add is charity ought to dominate this discussion, right? Neither side wants to see others gunned down. I think there's a habit of on the left of saying that, you know, the right doesn't care about school children and is happy to see them, you know, mowed down in large numbers as long as they get to keep their guns. And there's a habit on the right of saying that the left doesn't care if, you know, someone kicks in their door and opens fire and murders their family. And I think neither of those are particularly helpful. Nobody wants to see more people killed. And that ought to be remembered during sort of all public conversations.
Great. And so with all of that said, we thank everybody for listening to our podcast. We're really, really grateful. Whenever we get comments on our Facebook page or on our email or to our email address, which is cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com, we're always really grateful for everybody who listens to our show. Please leave us a review at iTunes to help other people find the show. We are proud members of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. Please do visit that Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. And let me finally remind everyone to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and to render unto God those things that are God's. Thanks so much for listening.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway,